Chapter 15. Skippy, I do not like this, I said again.
Colonel Joe, this is the seventh time you said that, Skippy replied, and the third time you have used those exact same words. You are repeating yourself.
You sure about that? I can play back the audio recordings if you like.
I would not like.
Didn't think so.
And I predicted you would not like this when I explained my plan to you originally.
I know you... We were interrupted by the comm system.
Dutchman, this is the flower. We are ready to depart.
It was Chang's voice.
I glanced over to the CIC. Everyone there gave me a thumbs-up sign.
Copy that, Colonel Chang. Good luck to you.
Roger, Dutchman. We'll be back as soon as we can.
There was a shudder as the flower detached from its hard point. With the artificial gravity off in the Dutchman, we felt all the ship's maneuvers. I watched on the main display as the flower slowly backed off on thrusters, spun around, then fired its main engines to move away to a safe jump distance. That little ship, little only by comparison to the massive star carrier, would be making two jumps to reach its destination. One jump away from the Dutchman to an area of dead space closer to the star where the flower would fire engines in a long burn to match course and speed with its final destination. Then a second jump to the L2 Lagrange point above the far side of the target planet's moon. The flower had to remain on the far side of that moon to mask the gamma ray burst from its jumps. Mask the gamma rays from the unexpected guests, the band of roughly 30 Kristang who were on the surface of the planet we needed to live on. They weren't supposed to be there. Skippy didn't expect them. The good news is there weren't many of them, and they didn't have a ship in orbit. From the limited communications Skippy had intercepted, he guessed these were a rather desperate band of down-on-their-luck Kristang dropped off on the planet to search for Elder artifacts. Some of the Kristang appeared to be prisoners or possibly slaves. They were all male, as far as Skippy could tell. Dropping off a couple Theranan stealth satellites would be one of the flower's first tasks, so we could gather more intel. One way or the other, the entire crew had to evacuate the Flying Dutchman, and the only place in range that could support 70 humans was Newark. Very soon, the Dutchman would run out of power for life support, and its highly eccentric orbit around the Jupiter-sized gas giant planet had the Dutchman dipping deep into the powerful radiation belts that surrounded the planet. Skippy was draining emergency power from the capacitors to power the shield generators around the forward part of the command section. The crew remaining aboard the Dutchman were crowded as far forward as we could get. When the ship reached the low point of its orbit and got fried by the radiation belts, we retreated into three interior compartments until the orbit took us above the worst of the radiation. It was not an optimal situation. With most of the crew now gone with the flower, Skippy adjusted life support so only the compartments we occupied got heat, light, and ventilation. The rest of the ship was growing cold, and we'd need breathing masks to get to the flower when that ship returned to evacuate us. It was damn good that I had decided, with the original merry band of pirates, to keep the battle-damaged flower. Having that ship as a lifeboat was saving our lives. There were 52 people squeezed into the flower, and the two Theranan dropships in the flower's docking bays. That many people needed too much oxygen and breathed out too much carbon dioxide for the life support system aboard the little frigate. They also generated too much body heat. That didn't even consider food, sleeping space, and other biological functions. For a short trip, the flower and dropships could support 52 people. It had better be a short trip. Chang brought supplies and the first wave of people down to Newark in two trips, each by the two dropships. Because we couldn't risk the Kristang seeing contrails from the dropships scorching their way down into the atmosphere, the dropships had to come in from far over the horizon and then fly low and relatively slowly to the landing site, burning additional time and fuel. Skippy assured us that through his control of the two Kristang satellites, the Kristang down there would not be able to see anything we didn't want them to see, such as Theranan dropships. Even with stealth and a slow, shallow entry profile, it was very difficult to hide the contrail of water vapor behind the dropships. Whether Skippy had control of the satellites or not, we could not prevent the Kristang from simply looking at the sky. Fortunately, the skies on Newark were most often cloudy and raining. Bonus. I was the last person to leave the Dutchman, taking the elevator up to the docking platform where the flower was parked. Because most of the star carrier no longer had life support, such as heat, lights, and oxygen, I was in an armored suit.
I stepped off the elevator carrying a small bag of personal items, a very small bag. Everyone had been cautioned about their meager mass allowance. That caused some grumbling, particularly among the scientists, so I wanted to set a good example. When the elevator stopped at the top and the door slid open, I hesitated before walking forward and stepping from one ship to another. Hopefully I would be coming back to the Flying Dutchman, that my journey aboard her was not over yet. After all, our pirate star carrier was named after a legendary ship that was doomed to roam the seas forever with her captain. The Dutchman was my first command, probably my only command. With a deep breath, I took one step forward, then another. The elevator door slid shut behind me, and I had left the Dutchman, for several months at least. There was no one to greet me. I walked forward halfway to the frigate's backup bridge before I saw another person. Since the fight when we captured the ship, we had repaired some of the battle damage. There were still bullet holes, scorch marks, and impacts from shrapnel that we hadn't gotten to yet, or had not bothered to patch up. Chang was in charge of fixing up the frigate. I suspected he wanted to leave some reminders of our desperate fight. Some things we couldn't fix, not without a major effort. The frigate's main bridge was still blasted apart from where Desai had shot it up with our stolen dodo. That seemed like a lifetime ago now, like it had happened to another person. Around a bend in the corridor, I found Portillo, one of our rangers, running a finger around a bullet hole. I caught his eye, and neither of us said anything. He pointed to the bullet hole and nodded silently. I nodded. Nothing needed to be said. He knew. I knew. We'd both seen combat. When I got to the backup bridge, the frigate's control center, I saw that, of course, Captain Desai was our pilot, right back where she first flew a starship. "Colonel," she said, half turning in her seat, "we're ready to depart." "Dropships are secured?" I asked. The Flower's two landing bays were crammed with a pair of Theranan dropships, packed full of supplies we needed for survival on Newark. The Theranan dropships barely fit in the Kristang frigate's landing bays. It took some slow, delicate flying to get them in. Once inside, because they didn't match up with the Kristang docking clamps, we had to tie the dropships down with cables. It wasn't an optimal solution. "They're secured," she reported. I sat down and tightened the seatbelt as far as I could. It was designed for the larger frame of a Kristang. "Proceed when ready, pilot."
"Aye, aye, Colonel," she replied. "Mr. Skippy, drop artificial gravity and release docking clamps, please."
There was a clanging sound and a vibration as the clamps released the frigate and artificial gravity faded away to nothing. "Done," Skippy said, a touch of melancholy in his voice. "Get out of here. I can't spare the power drain you monkeys create. Joe, I'll talk to you soon. Remember my advice. Be extra careful not to do anything stupid down there." "Got it. No problem. I will be extra stupid down there. I said..." "Oh, forget it. I'm going to be busting my ass up here fixing this ship. You'd better be around to see it when I'm done." We jumped in behind the moon again, even though the moon at that time was on the other side of the planet from the Kristang scavenger base. "Skip." I stopped myself right there. I'd gotten so used to asking him how successful a jump was, I had momentarily forgotten that he was now on the other side of the star system. A message sent from the Flower now would not be received by Skippy for almost an hour. I cleared the lump in my throat and said, "Skippy will be wondering whether we arrived safely. Please send him a message."
"Aye, aye," Desai acknowledged, and nodded to a co-pilot to handle that task. "Jump was successful, Colonel. We are off target by only 52 kilometers.
What she didn't say was that the Flower's return trip would not be nearly as accurate. Skippy had programmed the inbound jump for us. Before we left the Flower to land on Newark, we would be programming the frigate's return jump by ourselves, and I would trigger the jump remotely from the ground. On the return, we would be lucky if the Flower emerged within 100,000 kilometers of the gas giant planet which the Dutchman orbited.
"Seems odd, doesn't it, sir?"
"What?" I asked.
"To not have Skippy available whenever you want to talk to him. He talks to me constantly. Sometimes I wish he would go away." "Now that he's not here, I miss him," she said, and turned her attention back to the pilot controls.
"Me too," I said simply. It was odd. It felt lonely.
Ever since we escaped from the warehouse the Ruha had been using as a makeshift jail, he had always been right there in my ear, whether I wanted him or not. Until the other end of his magic micro-wormhole arrives at Newark, we were going to be out of communication. He could not transmit messages to us because the Kristang would detect the signals. Unstrapping from the chair, I floated free in the zero gravity.
Let me know when you have the return jump programmed. I'm going to assist with releasing our dropships.
The dropships each made one trip down to the surface, heavily loaded with supplies and the remaining crew. As soon as they were empty, they would be remotely flown back up to the flower, and I would trigger the return jump with my Z-phone. Chang was there when I walked down the ramp.
I can update you on the walk up to the caverns, Colonel, he offered.
Fighting my instinct as a proud grunt to help unload the dropship, I reminded myself that I was a colonel for the moment, the commander. My responsibility was to the entire group, not only to the people laboring to get cargo unloaded. I took a deep breath. It didn't seem refreshing because the oxygen level was low. The air smelled like mud and wet grass. Looking back, I saw the wide skids of the dropships had sunk deeply into the wet soil. Skippy would no doubt complain when he saw the underside of the dropships was splattered with mud. After the dropships took off, we would need to fill in the holes the skids had made.
Yes, that sounds good.
You'll notice first the higher gravity. 14% does not sound like much until you have been working for a while.
He pointed back to the dropship where people in armor suits were doing most of the heavy work.
Then it hits you. Everything takes more effort here.
It's like constantly wearing a backpack.
No, that's what I thought, Chang said with a frown. It's worse. Lifting your arms without anything in your hands gets tiring, because your muscles aren't used to the extra effort. Simply sitting, if you're reading something on your lap, your neck muscles are strained, like you're always wearing a helmet. Our medical doctors tell me that until we adjust, sleep will not be as refreshing, because the extra weight will make us shift more during the night. We will get sore more quickly from laying in one position. Standing will cause blood to pool in our legs. Our hearts will work harder to pump the same volume of blood. Then there's the lower oxygen level.
Yeah, I said, already feeling the lack of oxygen.
From where the dropship landed to the entrance to the first cavern was only maybe a bit over half a kilometer, and the climb less than 50 meters, I estimated. The terrain was rough. The canyon here narrowed with a stream cascading down rapidly over rocks. We had to walk part of the way in the stream bed, stumbling over wet, slick rocks.
And my lungs are feeling it, I acknowledged, and struggled to keep up with Chang.
He saw my distress and slowed, without saying anything that could embarrass me. I appreciated that.
How long for us to adjust?
The doctors aren't sure. Normal adjustment to high altitude is several days to a week. The difference here is the atmospheric pressure is slightly higher than sea level pressure on Earth. Here, the mix of oxygen is lower.
The doctors are concerned that we may be slow to adjust because we're taking in actually a greater volume of air with each breath that might fool our bodies into not realizing the oxygen deficiency. We will have to monitor people and ourselves for signs of altitude sickness. We already have people with headaches.
The list of people with headaches might include me.
Since our battle with the Theranan Destroyer Squadron, I had not been sleeping well, nor sleeping enough. There had been too much to do and too much to worry about. One thing I was hoping for on Newark was that with nothing much to do but remain concealed and wait for Skippy to fix the ship, we would have plenty of time to catch up on sleep. Except Chang said we'd need to adjust to sleeping in higher gravity.
Great.
What else have we learned so far? I asked.
We do have news that would be good, Chang said, except that it is useless to us. The life on Newark would be edible to humans, if there was anything here to eat.
He nudged a low-growing shrub with a boot.
The sugars and proteins that make up plants on Newark can be digested by humans. Unfortunately, all we found so far is grass, some shrubs, and a sort of lichen growing on the rocks. No land animal life other than microscopic organisms in the soil. In the stream, there are tiny things like water insects, tiny sort of shrimp, and a sort of fish, nothing larger than a few millimeters, nothing we could potentially eat. Our science team, he pointed to a group further up the canyon, up to their knees in the frigid water.
is enjoying this immensely. Even the people who are not biologists are pitching in to collect samples.
I could see Dr. Venkman, the science team leader and an astrophysicist, bending down to carefully scoop something out of the water. She looked like she had just found a gold nugget, and she was excitedly gesturing to the others. Dr. Zheng, the biologist, was actually kneeling in the stream, which had to be freezing cold. She was saying something to Venkman with a look of rapturous joy across her face. This was an entirely new biosphere for Zheng to explore, and she was the first human biologist to examine it, and the first human biologist to have access to Theranan technology. She, for one of us, was thrilled to be on Newark.
It's great they are having fun. Have they done anything useful?
Except they did already determine our biology is compatible with the native life.
I was intrigued.
How did they do that so quickly?
They used a Theranan scanner that is designed to do just that. Tell the Theranan whether a planet's organisms are compatible with their own. Since human and Theranan biology both use the same basic types of sugars and proteins, it was simple. And the science team has helped us validate that the caverns are suitable for us. You'll see. We've explored two major caverns here.
He pointed to two caves. One had a large, arched opening. The other cave's entrance was narrow and tall. The extra gravity was weighing me down already. It was damp, chilly, with dark gray clouds overhead, and it had just started to rain. This was going to be our home for months. Fantastic.
Let's get inside, I suggested.
Skippy made contact, of course, at 0224 hours on our sixth day on Newark. He had told me it would take 5 days for the missile to deliver our end of the micro-wormhole, and I had waited anxiously for a signal from him all the previous day. Anything could have gone wrong up there. If Skippy didn't contact us, we would be stranded on Newark and never know what had happened to the Flying Dutchman. After sitting up waiting for a signal on my Z-phone until well after midnight, I finally laid down on my cot and went to sleep. Skippy's muffled voice came out of the Z-phone under the rolled-up jacket I was using as a pillow.
Ugh.
I pulled the phone out, glancing at the time code in the upper right corner.
Hi, Skippy, I whispered.
Hey, Joe,
he shouted.
Skippy, I said in a harsh whisper. People are trying to sleep here. Everything okay up there?
Oh, sure, Joe, everything is wonderful. I'll tell you all about it. First, I...
Great, everything is wonderful, so this can wait until morning, right?
I'll talk to you then, I said through a jaw-stretching yawn.
What? I want to talk...
Good night, Skippy. This biological trash bag needs sleep.
In the morning, Skippy was initially peeved at me. Then he quickly cheered up. The missile had arrived on time the previous day. Then Skippy had to maneuver it into position, release the micro-wormhole, and test it. The Flower, with the two dropships, had arrived safely back at the Dutchman, and Skippy was busy taking the ship apart. He was extra chatty after being out of contact, and he wanted to see everything. After a quick breakfast, I gave him a tour of the caverns. Major Sims was in the back of the main cavern, still getting our small mountain of supplies unpacked.
Good morning, Skippy, she said. What do you think of our beautiful new home away from home?
Oh, it looks great. You did a great job. Looks very cozy, Skippy said.
Major Tammy, are you sure you want to trust Joe in a cavern you fixed up so nicely? He's not the best house guest. There have been incidents.
Ha, I laughed. Like what?
How about the time you thought your neighbor had a solid gold toilet and it turned out you peed in the guy's tuba?
Skippy,
I laughed. That never happened, I explained to Sims, who didn't look entirely convinced. Skippy snorted.
Oh, sure. If you say so, Joe.
That guy's still mad.
You need to remember, tequila is not your friend.
I sighed. Okay, maybe it did happen. In my defense, there was a lot of tequila involved. I don't remember that day at all. As far as I know, the whole tuba incident was a story somebody made up to embarrass me. On the other hand, everyone in my hometown knows that story, so maybe there was some truth to it. There are no tubas down here, Skippy. I think we're safe.
He said.
Might be best to set up a litter box for you, just in case. Sims had done an outstanding job of getting two caverns ready for human occupation. Cots were set up for sleeping, with tarps separating groups of cots so people had some privacy.
There were tables and folding chairs, although not enough for everyone to sit down and eat all at the same time. Lights were attached to the ceilings. Each of the two caverns would be getting a field kitchen. Meals would be less fancy than what we had become used to aboard the Flying Dutchman, but we would not be surviving entirely on MREs after the first couple days. Conditions were not harsh. I was not concerned about survival or people's health, even if the planet was chilly, damp, and generally unpleasant. I wasn't even that concerned about the inevitable boredom. The science team had plenty to occupy them, studying Newark and going through the mountain of data we had collected on the voyage so far. The Special Forces would no doubt be using Newark as an opportunity to train in a heavy-gravity, low-oxygen environment and to gain additional experience with powered armor suits. Keeping the pilots busy would be more of a problem. We hadn't been able to bring down any type of flight simulator gear, so they would have to do with flight manuals. Some of the pilots and Special Forces had already volunteered to collect samples for our biologists. I needed to encourage that spirit of teamwork. After a mostly decent first night of sleep, when I got used to my cot and the heavier gravity, I awoke early. Tiptoeing across the cavern, carrying my boots, I got a cup of coffee and went outside to sit on a rock and put my boots on. It didn't surprise me at all that Sergeant Adams appeared silently behind me. "Where are you going, sir?" Taking a sip of coffee, I answered, "Nowhere special, Sergeant. Just up to the rim so I can get a view of our cozy little canyon here. Hoping to see a sunrise." That last seemed unlikely. The sky was mostly clouds, and from the wet rocks outside the cavern entrance, it had rained again overnight. The science team was trying to figure a weather forecast from the satellite data. They weren't confident of understanding Newark's climate that well until we reconnected with Skippy. "No one goes outside alone, sir. Commander's orders." I had given such an order through my XO. "Well, sounds like a wise commander." "Jury's still out on that one, sir," she said, with a grin I could barely see in the dim light. "He's doing okay so far." "You ready?" She held up one foot for me to see her boots were already on. "Always." Because Adams had landed with the first wave on the very first dropship, she knew her way around. The canyon wall was steep, especially near the top. Without Adams, it would have taken me forever to find my way up to the canyon rim. Someone had scouted a route to the top already. There was a rope to hold onto for the final climb to the top. It was less steep than I expected. There was a glimmer of light on the eastern horizon. The satellite view from my Z-phone screen showed patchy clouds overhead, solid cloud cover with rain to the west, and slightly less clouds to the east. It was possible I could see a sunrise my first morning on Newark. That, I would take as a good sign. "Hey, I began to say. "Sir?" Adams asked. "Nothing," I said, embarrassed. "I was about to ask Skippy for a weather forecast. It's automatic by this point." She nodded. "I know what you mean. On the ship, I can't get away from him. Now I miss him already." "Me too." We sat silently for a while, watching the light grow as the local sun approached the horizon. With the increasing light, I could faintly see figures moving about on the floor of the canyon below us. The Spec Ops team commanders had asked me for permission to run early in the mornings. I ordered them to skip this first morning until we could scout the area on foot in daylight. It didn't surprise me they had gotten up early anyway to exercise in the canyon. Inevitably, some of them were going to climb to the canyon rim, and the silence would be disturbed. Before I missed the opportunity, I cleared my throat. "Can we talk for a minute?" She turned to look at me in the pre-dawn darkness, her face illuminated only by the glow of the unseen sun. "If you're going to tell me you think I'm cute, I already know that. Also, I would punch you, sir." I said stupidly, not knowing what else to say. "Other than that, I could use someone to talk to also," she added, saving me further embarrassment. "Why did you come back out here?" I asked quietly. "We've already had this conversation, sir. Skippy saved our whole planet, and we made a deal with him. No, Adams, I made a deal with Skippy. Not humanity, not America, not you. Me. I needed to go back out with Skippy, and we need enough crew to get his magic radio. That doesn't mean you needed to come along on this fool's errand. You've done enough. Marines never quit, sir, and we don't stop until the mission is done. This mission isn't done. Unless I missed a briefing along the way."
She wasn't going to answer my question. Not really. So I tried to change the subject.
Why did you join the Marines?
The truth is, I joined the Army because I wanted to get out of my hometown, and because my father served. What I figured was, I'm in for a couple years, do my duty, get money for college. When they rotated us back from Nigeria, I was hoping to stay stateside for a while. Then, the Ruhar hit us, screwed up all my plans.
My mother was a Marine, Adams explained.
I didn't know that, I said. That fact was probably in her personnel file, which I didn't look at. Had it needed to look at.
She was a sergeant also. When she finished active duty, she went into the reserves for 8 years. After the Ruhar raid, she volunteered again. When we came home, she was working security in Norfolk. My father got a job in the area. They're doing all right. When I told her I was volunteering to go back out, she didn't try to argue with me. My father did, not my mother. She assumed all along that I was going back out. Back out until the job is finished, you know?
Yeah, I know. The problem was, this mission might never be complete, unless it involved Skippy leaving us and the Dutchman stranded in deep space.
Did your parents believe your cover story?
No. They didn't say it. I could tell.
Same here. They knew not to ask.
My father? I laughed. Wanted me to write or something.
What did you tell him?
That I'd do my best.
You can't ask for more than that, sir.
I'm worried that somehow I've used up all our luck out here. This mission has been nothing but bad luck so far.
Skippy says there is no such thing as luck, she reminded me.
Yeah, Skippy says a lot of things, I cautioned her. He doesn't always know what he's talking about.
I have faith that we'll get out of this somehow. That you will get us out of this somehow, and get us back to Earth.
Oh, great. No pressure on me, then.
If you didn't want pressure, sir, you shouldn't be wearing those silver eagles, she said. Hey, look. Sun's coming up.
And so it was. There were patchy clouds on the eastern horizon, enough that we couldn't see the full disk of the local sun. We could see enough. Skippy also said there are no such things as omens either. I think he's full of shit about that. This, I pointed to the sunrise, I'm taken as a good omen. By the end of our first week on Newark, we had settled into a routine. Each morning I got up early, meaning 5:30, to run with a spec ops team. To avoid playing favorites, I joined a different team each morning. By 2 weeks in, the teams had started to mix. Smythe, Chang, and I wanted the teams to learn from each other and to bond as one team, not by nationality. Waking up at 5:30 was a luxury. The sun didn't rise over the horizon until 0600, and I didn't want people stumbling around in the dark unless we were specifically conducting night training. That morning, I ran with a mixed team of SEALs and French paratroopers. As usual, I was dragging in the rear, although it was encouraging that after a 10-mile run, I finished only 100 yards behind. It rained the whole time. I was eager to get out of my wet clothes and put on something dry, if not completely clean. Laundry facilities on Newark were rudimentary, despite the best efforts of Major Sims.
Ah, man, I said with a shiver. Now that we stopped running, I'm chilled to the bone. Anybody want a hot chocolate?
As soon as the words were out of my mouth, I regretted them. These were super fit soldiers and sailors who had just finished a hard training run, not little children playing in the snow.
That sounds great, Lieutenant Williams said to my surprise, and other people nodded general agreement.
Since our little talk in my office, I had warmed up to Williams, although Skippy was still suspicious, and he referred to him as Baldy Locks. We got hot chocolate made, from a mix, of course, and not as good as homemade. It was hot, it was chocolatey, and it was better than being outside in the rain. Other people wandered over to join us, including Sergeant Adams. It became like an impromptu party, only it was early in the morning, and we had cocoa instead of alcohol. Williams lifted his mug and asked,
Hey, you think maybe before they decided to sell a hot chocolate mix as quick, did they test market a product called Slow?
I laughed. For when you're not in a hurry?
Yeah, Williams said. Like they give you a cocoa bean and a stalk of sugar cane. You make your own cocoa powder.
That drew a laugh from the group.
Do-it-yourself hot cocoa, I asked.
My father used to joke about our neighbors who bought a do-it-yourself kit for a full set of oak furniture. Cheap,
What's that? Williams asked.
For $10, you get, I said while laughing at my own joke, an acorn and a saw.
That got a big laugh. Waiting for an acorn to grow into an oak tree would still be faster than some contractors out there, Williams said sourly. My parents gave a contractor a deposit to remodel their kitchen, back before Ruha raided Earth. So far, all he's done is tear out half the cabinets and disappear. That's why I really came out here, he added with a grin. The contractor is apparently not on Earth, so I figured he must be out here someplace. I'm going to hunt him down and drag him back to my parents' kitchen.
Yeah, I said, I know what you mean. My uncle hired a contractor to build an apartment above his garage. The guy tore the roof off, covered it with a blue top. Then he had to wait for some supplies. Then he hurt his back, or some crap like that. When it got to be November, the top started leaking. My uncle said screw it, and called my father and me. The three of us worked nights and weekends, including over Thanksgiving. Working in a garage with no roof in late November made me want to punch that contractor if I ever met him. Anyway, it rained all Thanksgiving weekend. We had a roof on by that time, but no heat in there. It reminds me of the weather on this miserable planet.
Hey, Joe, Skippy said from the Z-phone on my belt. Look on the bright side. With this cold, crappy weather, you don't need to worry about having a beach body this summer.
Yeah, I rolled my eyes. That's what I was worried about.
You know, all that shaving and plucking and waxing, Skippy mused.
Skippy, it's none of your business what the women here...
Oh, I was talking about you, Joe.
Very funny.
Hey, that reminds me. I've been meaning to ask you, Joe. Why do you shave down there in the shape of a lightning bolt? Wouldn't a question mark be more appropriate for you?
I don't shave anything, I protested as people began laughing. Adams slapped the table and had tears rolling down her cheeks. She was laughing so hard.
Question mark,
Adams gasped. She had to hold the table not to fall off a chair.
Oh, Skippy said innocently. Shoot. Sorry, Joe, is this one of those privacy things you talked to me about?
Don't worry. Your secret is safe with me, Skippy said, in a cavern full of people.
I don't shave down there, I said through gritted teeth. If I could, I would have strangled that beer can right then.
Aha, okay, got it.
Right, you don't.
I'm serious, Skippy.
I'm getting mixed signals here, Joe.
Can we drop the subject?
What subject?
See, I can be discreet.
I looked around the compartment at people who were having a great laugh at my expense and trying to avoid my eyes.
Why couldn't I have just left that beer can on a dusty shelf?